How to build up the immune system. Sorry, I'm sadistic. Make sure you email Dr. Danley and try to get the makeup. As soon as you know it, you can't make a section, like on the Monday section, and you're sick or something comes up, you know, slipped on ice and broke your leg, you're in the ER, you know, while you're conscious, try to text and say, can I come to one of the Wednesday classes? Because not only do we have a Wednesday section in that morning, but there's three more sections after that morning section. It goes all the way to 9 p.m. on Wednesday. There are a lot of sections on Wednesday, four sections for the other class, and they're doing the same experiments, so you could try to get in there if you can't. And then usually Friday that week of our makeup labs, but only if it's an excused absence, because every Friday they tear down the setups or change all the equipment to get ready for Monday, right? So you can, if you have the excused absence, you can then make that up on Friday. So Dr. Danley will coordinate the makeup labs on Friday. So definitely email as fast as you can if you can't make one of those labs on the Monday or the Wednesday morning. But if you know you have to be out, like on a Wednesday, let's say you have an interview or something sometimes, or you know something's going to come up and you have to miss the Wednesday, email Dr. Danley early enough that maybe she can slip you in on the Monday sections, right, so you can plan ahead. So that's the way to deal with the labs. Hopefully that'll help. But, you know, sicknesses happen too, and things happen like that, so definitely email as soon as you can to her so she can try to work that out so you don't lose points. Okay, where are we? We are somewhere. So I already, you know, I post things up in the quiz key, and then some people got me confused because I'm easily confused about maybe miskeying this, but I didn't miskey it. So let's go through that. You can actually download those things. So let's look through the quiz real fast. We can put that up on the screen here, I guess. Now, sometimes partners are really helpful, but sometimes partners might hurt you. if you know your answer, argue with your group to really say, no, I think it's this answer, or, you know, rebel or something, arm twist, whatever it takes, if you know you got the right answer, right? Because then some of the grades were lower than I expected and things like that. But anyways, let's go through this and make sure that we're all on the same page. So in the presence of oxygen, favorable conditions with metabolic pathways R2 proceed? Well, we know glycolysis can go forward if you have oxygen, right? It's not being inhibited, right? And you know that citric acid in the TCA cycle can go forward, right? If you have oxygen. And the electron transport chain can go forward if it has oxygen around, right? So, any surprises there? Some misses on that one? All right. This might be a little confusing for people, but we talked about it, and I kind of gave a silly way to remember it. If you increase the cholesterol content in the membrane under physiological conditions, what was the weird tangent I told you about to try to remember? You remember that? These corny things I tell you? These corny things you're supposed to remember to stay in your brain? If you go into a kindergarten room, right, you're going to help out in the life science day, the little rugrats, I mean the kindergartners, are like little cholesterol molecules, right? What happens to your mobility? Increased or decreased? Decreased. Okay, so now we won't forget that, right? So rugrats, don't write rugrats on an open response question, but okay. It's, you know, you get the relationship there. Corny things, but they help you remember it. Okay. Yes.
For the question, so is it the increased fluidity in protein cells? Is that because I know I'm
joking. Yeah, it depends on where, at the level that you use. So let me go to this little page over here for a second. And if we go down on our webpage, right here, this extra note that's on there. The issue about cholesterol and fluidity in relation to Bio-350, animal physiology, not bacterial cells, right? And if you follow that through, actually, in this Lotus, which is a really good textbook in cell biology, but it's at really high concentrations, unphysiological. So in experimental lab situation, you can do that kind of experiment. But under physiological terms, we have to fit it in that parameters, all right, for animal foods. So this is why I put up this note, because it depends on which class you had and maybe which textbook that you're looking at. So this could be confusing. That's why I try to make an emphasis on that point. Okay. So action potential, right? Everybody knows the shape of the action potential. You should know it. Tattoo it if you like. But you can't use your tattoo and exam, you have to cover it up. All right. But, you know, upstroke, right? Voltage-gated sodium channels. Why doesn't it go to the peak? Two main things, what we should have down in our heads. Why is two main things we don't go to E sodium? I know some of you, if you don't, if you're asking what E sodium is, you're in bad shape for Monday. The open potassium channels. The other thing is inactivation of the voltage-gated sodium channels, right? And then you come back down. And if it goes below the resting membrane potential, what does that probably tell you about the E-potassium in relationship to the resting membrane potential? It's more negative. Watch out when we say those terms less or more. Always put it in context with where you are, because then I won't know if you mean less, like less negative or less, you know, more negative.
What deactivates the voltage-gated sodium channel to, like, make it... Uh-huh.
No, it doesn't make it come back down so much. It makes it where the channel will not be open anymore. So the question was, what makes the voltage-gated sodium channel inactivate? Let's go through the whole scenario. The amino acids in the voltage, in the protein, the voltage-gated channel, sense the voltage change across the membrane. Those little amino acids then have a conformational change because they're charged. And that charge then causes a conformational change. They open up, then they become an ion channel, but they continue to move, let's say. And it's a conformational change in the protein, and then it's not open anymore. And it doesn't go back to a reset value until the membrane comes back down to rest for some period of time, so those amino acids can sense the voltage change back to the initial condition and go back into their original conformation and then open up again. That's the easiest way to try to think about it. A lot of textbooks show and it's been shown now, there is a protein, the channel has a chain that goes inside of the cell, so intercellular now, that can block the pore. And that senses the voltage across the channel. And that little chain that goes in and blocks the pore stays blocked if it's positive on the inside compared to negative now on the outside, like that voltage change. And then it takes some conformational change to pull that little chain out of the pore, so it has to go back to the original charge across the membrane. Okay, so the idea in many things in cell biology, our enzymes, our proteins working, is the key word is conformational change in the protein structure. Like making an enzyme active, what's a conformational change, right? Phosphorylation. Why does phosphorylation make the pump work or anything, you know, change or the enzyme turn on or turn off? A conformational change, like hiding the active site, for example, in an enzyme. Okay.
So we do need to know the specifics of the activation and inactivation gates and the voltage gates.
Not yet. We'll get into a little bit more of that stuff. But if you really are dying for more of that, neurophys class 446, bio next year in the fall. Right. Everybody knows to avoid it now. Okay. All right. Sorry. So we won't get too crazy with it. All right. And this relates to the absolute refractor period, like what you just mentioned. It has to have some time before it can be reset, right, with that potential across the membrane. And that's the absolute refractor period, the time it takes for that protein that changes conformation back at a resting state so it can open up again. So if you give a second stimulus too soon after the first one, you can't open up those channels. Absolute. Where some of them are coming back in conformation, that's the relative refractor period. When you get them all rejuvenated, then you're back to, you know, within that relative refractory period, which relates to your lab. So remember, the lecturer, we're trying to relate to the lab. So kind of a word of warning, you might see some traces that were familiar with your lab experiments, right? Because we're integrating the lab and lecture components for the same content. Get the hint? Yeah, okay. All right, so you might see some diagrams that look familiar or should look familiar. Okay, now this one, some people were, I don't know, confused, I guess, maybe. So let's go through this. E chloride, this is what we just said with, you know, hyperpolarization for the resting membrane potential, for example. If E chloride is minus 90 and the resting membrane potential is minus 70, how much difference do we have here? 70, 80, 90, 20 millivolts, right? And all of a sudden, the chloride channel's open for the membrane that's at rest. It wants to go to the E chloride, right? So you're going to go from minus 70 going down towards minus 90. And the cell is at rest. What would happen? So what's going to happen? Chloride channels are going to rush in, right? It's going to go to the E chloride, right? It's going to go to the E chloride. Because chloride, so this is kind of testing two different things. One, that you know chloride's higher outside the cell. And two, that if E chloride's here and resting membrane potential's here, and all of a sudden you open up chloride channels, it wants to go to E chloride, right? So chloride's going to go into the cell and make it go down to that level. So try to get your head around these E potassium, E sodium, E chloride in relationship with resting membrane potential.
Would there ever be a case where the electrochemical and the electrostatic gradients are conflicting? So like where the charge is would favor not going in, but then the concentration gradient?
Yeah, that's kind of always... So the question was about the electrochemical gradient and the balance. It's kind of always happening. Right? And that's what establishes the E chloride or E sodium or the resting membrane potential. So if there was no chemical gradient, then you wouldn't have that electrical gradient, right? Yeah. And if you didn't have the electrical gradient, you couldn't set up the chemical gradient. So this is the way to think back and forth on the Nernst equation. So you could have a potential difference across a permeable membrane, right? It has to be permeable. A permeable membrane, if you put two poles, like positive and negative over here, and it's permeable, well, you're going to attract negative over here and positive over here. So you set up the concentration gradient. What level is that concentration gradient, or what does it go to? Then you could plug it in the Nernst equation, or the Goldman-Katz, if you assume permeability. And then you can determine the concentration that you would probably end up with. And then they went back and tested the concentration gradients, you know, with the two different poles, made the different solutions, and you can see the potential difference. So they're testing it both ways. So that's a good question. So try to make sure you get your mind around the equilibrium potentials and driving gradients. All right. Single quantum. We know what that means now, right? Vesicle in the nerve terminal fusing. Do not confuse this. We see this, and I don't know if it's just confusion maybe from other classes or something. The vesicle doesn't go across the synapse, right? So vesicles are not going across the synapse. It's like exocytosis. It binds to the membrane, releases transmitter, right? Now, there are some new terms that we should be familiar with
exomes. Exomes is a new thing in biology that's very exciting. You're going to see more and more about it. I don't know if you covered it in cell biology. Anybody hear about exomes yet? Cell biology? I mean, this is like fascinating stuff. So while we're on that tangent really fast, I'm going to get off this exam just for a second because it's such an important tangent. Okay. Science Daily. Subscribe to Science Daily. It is so fantastic. Just go, you know, search for Science Daily, and you can select different things that you're interested in. You just select Science Daily just for the fun stuff. Every morning, before your legs get out of bed, before the blood starts circulating, you can wake up and get excited about science because they'll hit the latest things the day before that were published in science, and it's really cool. And you get like lots of little hits. And you can think some things are fun. I mean, they built a robotic fish that can mimic another zebra fish. But not only that, that robotic fish senses what the other fish is doing, a real fish, and then can mimic that, and then you can see social interactions. Is that not cool? I mean, stuff like that is so neat, right? But there's another article here that kind of hit me that was really interesting. Where was this thing? Oh, yeah. Magpies, these birds as a group, they can learn from each other, and they're smarter by having groups actually working together. And I was thinking back, well, some groups made a 5 on the quiz and a 6, so maybe that group work didn't work so well, but other groups might have. So maybe it depends on the colony of the magpies, you know. So anyways, Science Daily, really neat things. And then you'll hear about exomes. So while we're on that tangent of exomes, because I don't want you confused with normal chemical synaptic transmission. So normal chemical synaptic transmission, what happens? Exocytosis, right? Not a whole vesicle going across. But they do know of these terms now called exomes. So your muscles, your heart, your brain, actually vesicles pinch off and can go into your bloodstream. Is that not cool? And it's kind of the contents of whatever that cell is. So they think now that your skeletal muscles, biggest mass in your body, can actually release exomes into your bloodstream, into your capillary beds, and travel in your body, and then can fuse with another cell somewhere else in your body. Is that not cool? That's really cool. That's phenomenal. And so now people are isolating. We have a group over here in the rehabilitation sciences, Esther DuPont Van Steeden. She's in the PT program, physical therapy program. She actually is isolating those, and they're having effects and seeing what they do if they isolate those from one rat with different conditions and put them on cultured muscle cells in a dish and see how it changes the properties. This is really quite neat stuff that's going on. So people have found these, and then people said, well, if muscles can do this, if your liver can do this, if other cells can do this, could your brain do this? So then they started to look in the nervous system, and they found out that neurons can butt off little vesicles. It's not the same as a synaptic vesicle, but it has contents of inside that cell. And so you think about microRNAs, other things that are labeled in that cell, can go into those little exomes and then fuse around, and then since it's a lipid, you know, molecule, it can actually fuse into another cell. So it could deliver contents into another cell. So it's revolutionized the whole field. So people have jumped on this. A lot of grant applications went up on this. So people are really researching this as the latest topic. They really wonder, you know, what are the consequences of this? Because this is like new stuff, right? This is really, that's what's the beauty of science. You find something new, completely unexpected, and then realize, hey, this could change the whole gamut. It's like epigenetic factors, right? People are like, well, that wouldn't happen, right? Acetylation, methylation, what are they talking about? It can't be. But then they find out, yes, it can. It can affect the offspring, the next generation, right? So it's really quite cool to think about these things. So just keep motivated. I'm trying to give you a pep talk, you know, science pep talk. All right. All right, so the NMDA and AMPA receptors and all that good stuff. We just talked about that right before the quiz, but some people might have been. One person actually said they were studying for the quiz, so they didn't pay attention in class. Okay, but we tried to make the content in the class related to the exam, and that's why I was rushing to make sure I got to that point before the quiz, right? There was a point for that. So LTP, long-term potentiation, the idea in the hippocampus, when they repetitively stimulated the nerve, the synapse, that these proteins underneath the membrane could be incorporated in the membrane. These are channels, AMPA. These are glutamate receptors. They are channels. And then that could change the activity. So next time you stimulate, if you have more receptors there, you got more activity, right? That's the idea behind the LTP. And then if you stimulate too long or do something else or repetitively stimulate, is usually the case, for a long time, you can actually have those receptors pulled into the membrane, out of the membrane, into the inside of the cell. And then you have fewer AMPA receptors, so when you stimulate, what's going to happen? Less of a response, so to LTD, long-term depression.
Is that
desensitization? It's kind of a form of desensitization, but what they're... You have to watch out for the terms when you use the terms too, and it is confusing. Desensitizing is really kind of referring to the receptor, not sensitive anymore. So this is like and you have to think about, people might use the word downregulation, but that's kind of confusing too, because when you think of that, you're thinking of mRNA expression and downregulation at a protein expression level. So really the protein's still there, it's just out of the membrane. So this little debate about like AMPA receptors going in the membrane and coming out of the membrane, that went on for about 10 years in the literature, published in Nature and Science. And the scientists were arguing about it because there was a group saying, oh no, this long-term potentiation, this facilitated type of response, had to be presynaptic. Remember the crayfish scenario, residual calcium and LTA, phosphorylation, it's all presynaptic. More vesicles would fuse. But then people are showing this in the hippocampus and saying, no, it's all post because it's AMPA receptors changing. And then these groups got together and realized it's really prep dependent and the stimulation dependent and how these changes are occurring. So let's back up a little bit because the nature of science is really important to understand too. So what do we mean when we say the nature of science? Anybody? What is this? Like fantasy? What does this mean? Researchers just go off on a tangent and think about crazy things or something. Based on evidence, right? Experimentation, working it out, looking at the data, your responses, you come up with a postulation, you test it, retest it, look at it different ways. Maybe then, you know, it's so substantiated that, like gravity, right? Everywhere you go, you measure gravity pretty much, right? So it becomes a strong theory. You try to keep testing that and disproving it, right? So think about what they did with this project. They tried to test it in all different ways. Here's the problem. Anybody work in a lab and use antibodies? Antibodies? Okay. So how do you stain your cells? Do you look at a protein that's inside of a cell or outside the cell? Or do you run it on Westerns, for example?
We run Westerns a lot, but normally we're staining for proteins within the cell.
So staining for proteins in the cell, and I don't mean to put you on the spot.
It's okay.
But so how do you process your tissue to get the antibody in that might be labeled like with a fluorescent probe or something?
Yeah.
How do you get it into the cell to stain that, to recognize that protein, the antigen that you're trying to find?
So usually the antibody is with a solution and it's specific for some protein or particle within the cell, and then when it's tagged with a fluorescent marker, then we can use that to image that part of the cell.
Was there any way to get that antibody into the cell? Do you remember any technique that you might have used? Do you process the tissue?
Usually you put it in some sort of reagent for like hydrogen peroxide or something to...
Okay, hydrogen peroxide. Anything like with Triton, for example?
Yeah.
Triton? Okay, so that's a key element. So Triton, this is a good point. Triton is a soap. It pokes little holes in the membrane. So you might stain up your preparation, like for these AMPA receptors, right? And they had an antibody for it. And then they put it on the prep and they say, before LTP and after LTP, they still got the staining. What's the problem here? You still got the staining, and you use Triton X that pokes little holes in it, and you're staining for that protein, AMPA. Pardon?
Like leave the cells?
Still, they fix it, like with glutaraldehyde or something, probably your fixation or something. The problem is they didn't have the resolution. Is it in the membrane? Or is it right underneath the membrane, right? They're poking holes and staining for this protein until they could actually see the resolution. So then somebody thought, let's not permeabilize the cell. Let's try to stain and get the antibody to recognize the cell surface of the AMPA. And then they found everything to be different. So you see that little technique change in the nature of science of doing something, right? Experimentation came up with a new approach to do this. And then figured out what's going on. And then the resolution of like confocal microscopy, you could actually see, is it in the membrane or is it underneath the membrane? And that opened up the whole field. This is important because this is the basis of what? Memory, right? How you can remember things, how your brain functions, how you can remember for Monday's exam, right? This is all part of it, the activity in the synapses and things. So I know we're rehashing some stuff, but hopefully it comes back and hits us really good here. Okay, we talked about cadmium. Why would cadmium block synaptic transmission? What's the thing about cadmium?
Blocking
the voltage-gated calcium channels in the presynaptic nerve terminal, right? So what I'm trying to also emphasize great is to make sure you have a full statement there, right? When you're answering short answers or essay questions, you know, where is it blocking? What? How is it doing it? What's going on? Higher magnesium will also block it, right? And this is where y'all tried to confuse me after the exams, after the quiz, but then I didn't mess up the card. The sodium-potassium pump, remember that other crazy scenario I told you about with water beds a long time ago, right? No? Everybody purged crazy tangents? The poison that's inside of there to keep the antifungus, the azide, for example, blocks the electron transport chain. You block the electron transport chain, you can't make ATP. If you can't make ATP, what happens? You can't keep the sodium-potassium pump going. You can't keep the sodium-potassium pump going. What happens to your cells? They depolarize, right? Because it's always keeping that balance of the leak that's going on. And then if you depolarize, your nerves can't work, your muscles can't work, and you die, right? So, a real problem. So the pump is so important. That's that, if you go back and you like the physics, which I know many of you don't like physics, but you went back to that example of the resistor and the capacitor, you know, the resistor and the capacitor across the membrane, and then you saw the battery. The battery is the pump, right? So the battery in that biological membrane that we've mimicked in the physics terms with the resistor, capacitor, and that battery is your sodium-potassium pump that gives rise to that difference. Okay. So slowly depolarize. All right, so some other things that happen here. Number 10 with saturated and unsaturated fatty acids. Back to your bilipid membrane, right? If it's really nice and tight, it's pretty rigid, right? What's the unsaturated mean? Got kinks in it, right? Got kinks in it. Because it's not saturated, the carbon chain is not saturated with hydrogen ions anymore. So if you got a bunch of kinks in there, is the fluidity going to go up or down? Bunch of kinks, unsaturated, fluidity increases, right? Increases. So if an animal is put in the cold, like today, you're out there chilling, what's going to happen to the butter when you take the butter out and put it in the freezer? Right? It gets hard. It gets too rigid. How could that butter, if it had an ability to change, what would it do to make itself back to normal, like at room temperature? Change the hydrocarbon chains, right? Become more unsaturated, so you increase your fluidity. So this is what happens with animals over testing them if you're exposing them to the cold or exposing them to warm. Now, what if this question is reworded another way? What happens if you move them to the warm versus the cold over a period of time? Becomes too, you know, it's melting the butter, right? So you want the butter to harden up. So now you're going to try to make them saturated so they're more rigid, right? Okay, so keep all that straight. If this was a mystery to you going over this, we need some help. Okay? All right, so definitely we can go over things. Or make sure you look at echoes or podcast. If you need a book, you know, there's some books in the library on animal phys, but if you haven't ordered them yet, maybe if you need some help, you might want to get some of those. Okay. So let's go back to where we were over here. And I know I kind of sped through this because I wanted to get to some key points for the quiz that day, right? Let's go back to transmitters a little bit, and we're going to save that to draw on. Most of the transmitters, as we mentioned, is it the transmitter that makes it excitatory or inhibitory synapse? No. What is it? The receptors, exactly. And we gave this example with serotonin, right? Serotonin, it's a nice transmitter, but depending on the receptor it binds to, it could inhibit a cell, it could excite a cell. So it's receptor dependent. Okay, so the idea is that these neurotransmitters are generally small molecules, right? Because they've got to diffuse. And they usually have an amino acid base to them, many of them, right? They're common. they actually think evolutionarily that ATP might be the first neurotransmitter. Because, and it's not in your text or anything, but every vesicle that they've looked at in synaptic transmission, they've always found co-packaged ATP inside there. Isn't that kind of interesting? ATP is always inside of those vesicles too. They don't really know why, but there was a really neat experiment that was done. And here you just think, blows your mind away again. This guy, Rochelle Robertai, at McGill University in Canada, he was actually looking at the frog neuromuscular junction. And I'll just draw this on the board. It's just so cool. Science. And it's much more important than memorizing some other fact. But anyways. So he looked at the neuromuscular junction in the frog. And he was using a calcium indicator. All right, so you could use these calcium indicators that would go inside of cells. It's called like a calcium AM indicator. Anyways, it goes inside the cell, it de-esterifies, and then it's localized inside cells. So he was putting this calcium indicator, I'll just write I indicator, it would get inside of cells, and it would get inside this supporting cell that's around the neuromuscular junction too. Well, and he would stimulate the nerve, and he was looking at calcium responses inside the nerve. So he would stimulate here and look at calcium responses in here. Well, the issue, when he stimulated at the frog neuromuscular junction, so this was the frog, acetylcholine is a transmitter, he found out these supporting cells that are next to the neuromuscular junction, these little supporting Schwann cells, that they were lighting up too. He said, how do they light up? Why are they lighting up? They're just supporting Schwann cells around the neuromuscular junction. They shouldn't be lighting up. They don't have acetylcholine receptors, do they? Maybe they do. So then he puffed on acetylcholine and found out they didn't light up. Wow, what's going on? He was like, this is mystifying. Is it something about electrical activity? Were there like gap junctions between them? What's happening? So he said, well, you know, I don't know. Could there be something else being released, you know, from the nerve terminal? And then he thought, this is really old literature back in the 1960s and, you know, stuff like that. And there's something else in the vesicles people found. It was ATP. What if I put ATP on the preparation? So he put ATP on the preparation, on the bath. And boy, they lit up just like gangbusters. So there are purinergic receptors on those peripheral Schwann cells. And what did he do from that? Well, he got the cover of a Journal of Neuroscience like three issues in a row showing this. I mean, it was such hot things. And then some people were saying, well, gosh, we knew about that, you know, years ago that ATP was released, but how come we never thought it didn't do anything, right? So you see, this is really neat. This is that whole part about science that's really cool. So now they think that these purinergic receptors that are on these cells actually are giving feedback and help maintain the neuromuscular junctions, actually help to maintain that response, that little local environment there at the neuromuscular junction, which could then change how your muscles work. And now you wonder, what about in the brain? Do these have effects on neighboring cells in the brain? So that's really quite neat, too. All right, so you just kind of, you know, really fun things. I lost my little thing. Okay. There it is. Okay. So these transmitters, really neat, epinephrine, dopamine, and you can see that, you know, the effects could be different, but basically, you know, they're simple molecules in the sense based on amino acids synthesis. And then you can think about some other types of transmissions that are going on. Like nitrous oxide. Now, nitrous oxide is a gas, right? So they think that the target cell that maybe activity, it could make nitrous oxide and give a retrograde feedback back to the nerve terminal and actually have some influence. So that's pretty neat. And there's your ATP and histamine release as well. So depending on the neuron, and then you think about why is one neuron releasing GABA and another neuron releasing glutamate? And another one releasing acetylcholine. What do you think might be different in these neurons? What could be different, do you think? Receptors for what? So the neurons are making these transmitters, right? Receptors for maybe uptake? Yeah, maybe uptaking certain amino acids, but
you know, cells need all the amino acids, right, to make the proteins inside of the cell and all that kind of stuff. So all cells need amino acids to make proteins and to make pumps and channels and keep things alive and keep moving, right? So maybe there's something else that's going on inside these neurons, right? Why would it release acetylcholine and not GABA or not glutamate or serotonin? Or could it release both? Maybe there's co-packaging of norepinephrine and serotonin together in a vesicle. So part of it is really quite interesting. So people debated for many years about this topic, and it went on for a good while. So if we think of the nerve terminal, and we think of the vesicle inside of there, part of it is, you know, what's being uptaken in the nerve, right? But amino acids have to all be inside the cell. So what's different here? It's just because it's taken up in the cytoplasm doesn't mean it's going to get in the vesicle, right? So there are transporters in the vesicle itself, vesicular transporters, that can transport compounds into the vesicle. All right. So this is really quite neat because there's some really fundamentals in therapy that's used in altering synaptic transmission. So let's think about one of these processes. So I'm going to draw this a little bit bigger. So this is just a vesicle I'm drawing, okay? So the idea is in the vesicle, how does a neurotransmitter get in there? It just can't. It's just going to diffuse through this transporter, right? But something has to drive it, right? Something has to make it go against the concentration gradient to get in there, right? So how is it packaged? So the idea is that there's actually a pump, an ATP pump, that pumps hydrogen ions into the cell. Isn't that wild? So now, hydrogen ions become very high in concentration. Let's see if that... I don't know if you can see that okay or not, or whatever. Yes. So hydrogen ions building up inside the cell. So now you've got a concentration gradient of hydrogen ions. But then how does that work with transmission? Well, there are still unknowns to this process. Isn't that wild? Something so fundamental to every animal that has a nervous system, I mean, from earthworms to C. elegans to Drosophila to you, and all the brain, how it works, is then how is it then this my package transmitter? Well, one system's kind of been worked out, and that's glutamate. So they know that glutamate can come in the vesicle through a type of protein, but it's thought that this only happens possibly with a hydrogen exchange out. That's one of the ideas. But on top of this, there has to be, there's a chloride binding site to make this work. Now, isn't that wild? That's just wild. So you set up a hydrogen gradient. This is one of the ideas. Still, there's some debate on this, but this is one of them. That hydrogen ions build up in here. This is known to happen. All of the vesicles are acidic compared to the cytoplasm. They know that. That's a given. But how this actually is working is still kind of a mystery a little bit. They think it's an antiporter, basically. Glutamate in and the hydrogen out. If you block this pump, you don't have the hydrogen gradient. It doesn't fill up with glutamate. That's known, too. But this chloride binding site is kind of interesting. Anybody know why that might be interesting? What might be interesting about that? That it can be blocked. It can be blocked. And what's really interesting is you think about epilepsy, right? And maybe you know somebody with epilepsy. It's a horrible disease, right? Children that have epilepsy might have, you know, 20 seizures in an hour or a day, and their brains are really messed up. And they know now with imaging that one grand mal seizure can actually permanently change the brain function. So that's not good to keep having these. Some people, you might have heard of some people with agraphia, where part of their half the brain doesn't develop. It's really small, and the other half is growing just right. They know in many of those cases that they're going to have epileptic seizures later in life. So I have a nursing friend that actually, her daughter had this problem. And she was a nurse in an ICU, in an ER, and she noticed her two-year-old, all of a sudden, you know, kind of like she always thought they had a little trance. And then they realized, oh, that trance doesn't look right. It was not responding. And then she realized, oh, God, all these years, you know, the 2 years that she had this kid, she took it to the ER right away so they could do imaging on the brain and found out this kid was having multiple seizures all the time. Then looked at the, you know, MRI and found out half the brain didn't develop, went up to Cleveland Clinic, had half that part of that brain removed.
So they can catch it early on, but you can see that, you know, things happen like this. And so they know that these can be problems, and there's all different severities of this kind of disease. So in other people, the children that have it, sometimes they'll go in and try to remove that center. But then the scar tissue forms, and that can actually cause more epilepsy. So there's lots of cases with this, like injuries in the brain. Pretty neat. So another kind of situation is that what they do for epileptics is they might take medications. And in some cases, it's mild, and the medications work really well. In some cases, the medications don't work at all. And they're having to take really strong medications. What kind of medication do you think you would take? What process would you want to take to decrease synaptic transmission? Pardon? Something that might block those. That's a good point. And there wasn't really known drugs right at the time. What else do we know about synaptic transmission? What action potential comes down, opens up? Voltage-gated calcium channels, right? So they use calcium channel blockers. What do you think that does to the whole brain and your function? Not so great, right? So you're kind of like, you know, not being able to move around and do things and enjoy life, right? So this is really bad. So there's actually a guy that I went to grad school with. He was really neat. He works at the University of Chicago. And he does something so exciting. And he just loves what he's doing, but it's very stressful for him. So he actually patch clamps onto neurons. And he's working with the University of Chicago. They get an epileptic child in, which isn't following any medications that they can use. But they know cocktails work, but some of these cocktails have really bad side effects. I don't mean to drink cocktail. I mean a cocktail of different pharmacological agents, right? And the problem is that, you know, if they gave it to him right away, it could cause more damage. So what they're doing is they have this kid with a seizure. They can localize that part in the brain, imaging it. They actually go in and take a little piece of the brain tissue out, put it in a culture dish, and they could call him ahead of time. It might be, you know, 2 a.m. or so, whatever, in the morning that they're doing this because they're trying to get things rolling. And then he actually goes to the lab, calls in his grad students, technicians. They all work until they're done with their whole assay. They then screen all these different medications on those brain cells from that child until they get the right cocktail of drugs that will suppress this electrical activity. Because maybe it has more calcium channels or more sodium channels or more different type of potassium channels or some mutation in those. And then they come up with a cocktail that's working in the lab in a culture dish of that kid's brain cells. And then they design that cocktail in the lab. And then they go ahead and give it to the child and see if it decreases their epileptic seizures. That's pretty cool stuff, right?
How's that get FDA approval?
Well, because there's the other options are not...
Oh, they're okay with it?
Yeah, they have to. Think about the case. Anybody ever read Brain on Fire? Nobody's read Brain on Fire? If I had enough money to give me enough pay raise, I'd buy you all the textbooks. The STEMCATS last year, we had a STEMCATS class. I bought everybody the STEMCATS class, the book on Amazon.com. Used books, Brain on Fire. This is a perfect example. So if you want something, you know, exciting to read after your exam on Monday, look up Brain on Fire. Wonderful story. So I just need to go into this now. Another tangent, I know. And then we're going to take the quiz. So it's really quite cool. She was, I forget exact story, she was like a newspaper reporter or science writer or some kind of reporter in New York. All right? They thought she was crazy. Anybody? Nobody's heard of Brain on Fire? Yeah. Fantastic, right?
I didn't.
You didn't read it yet?
No.
Okay. So she was a science writer, and they thought she was losing her mind. They thought she was wacko. She was having delusions, seeing things, having voices in her head. And, you know, so what would you think if somebody was telling her all that? Psychotic, right? So she went to a psychiatrist, and they said, oh, yeah, she is crazy, wacko. And she's having these real big problems, and they, you know, so at the final time, she was actually so bad off that they were actually going to institutionalize her in a psychiatric institute. But somebody came around and said, you know, her symptoms don't really fit this bipolar, schizophrenic, depression thing that you're actually describing this as, because it's not fitting the standard checkoff list. There could be something else going on. And so fortunately, this other doc, which was from Syria originally, it was kind of written up, and it's a big hit because here where he was, a Syrian doc that came to the U.S., immigrated here, went through medical school, and then became a physician and a neurosurgeon kind of guy, said, this isn't fitting this. And he then went through and said, there's this other group, and I think it was in Pittsburgh, yes, where they're looking at these kind of abnormal cases like this. maybe you need to go over there. And so they did. And guess what they did? They said the only option we have really to test to see if you have this at this time was to take a brain biopsy. So they went ahead and took a brain biopsy out, put it on the slide next to a rat brain, stained it up for these kind of responses that they were getting for it. Antibody, so it's an autoimmune disease, to what? Your NMDA receptors. What are the NMDA receptors? Glutamate receptors. She had an autoimmune response to the protein for the NMDA receptors. So think if you're building up antibodies to your NMDA receptors and attacking them. What's happened? Your brain has gone crazy, right? So they found out she had this disorder. Give plasmapheresis, get rid of that antibody response, completely it's normal. So she wrote this book going through her whole scenario where her family thought she was crazy and then thinking about how many people were institutionalized with this kind of condition, and really they just had antibodies to the NMDA receptors, not autoimmune disorder. So she wrote this book for the layman. Okay, so it's really quite amazing. She wrote this and then how people were testing this out, you know, with brain biopsies. And then what she was so excited about, there was this case, a family that brought their child into the ER and said, look, this kid's going crazy. We think, and we just read this book that's kind of interesting. Do you think that she could have the same disorder? You know, everybody wants to try to solve the problem, right? And the physician said, no, it's not related to this thing. Well, they said, push it. We want to find out. We want to test her for if she's developing these antibodies, this autoimmune disease, because it looks just like this scenario that's written in this book that they got off the shelf somewhere in a, you know, 5 and 10 dime store. And then the doctor said, oh, gosh, guess what? She has it. And so by writing this textbook, they found many cases all across the country. A friend that I told you about that did the CO2 in Fadre, that he went to UC San Diego, and I said, hey, have you read Brain and Fire? He said, yes, we read Brain and Fire. And guess what? We had the author to come and talk to our medical class here. So, you know, so cool, because now they're finding cases all over. They have cases up at Cincinnati Children's Hospital where they found this. Just so really quite cool. But you think about how they have to do these kind of experiments. Okay, so what I covered today so far isn't really on this quiz, but hopefully you get the idea that there's some really neat things. So we got a quiz, we got open response questions, and some multiple choice questions. But there's a lot of room in this room here. So what we're going to do is divide up. No two people next to each other. Spread out, right? Spread out. You got lots of space up here. People in the back. No looking over people's shoulders. This is individual. This is not your group effort. And eyes on your own papers. Put your name on it.
Separate up there. There's two.